Kære lyttere af madridister.dk, den følgende podcast er på engelsk. Sådan må det være, når det lykkes os at få et kæmpe, kæmpe scoop i hus. Madridister.dk har nemlig sat sig ned og snakket med sit love. Manden bag flere legendariske podcasts, bag spændende bøger og ikke mindst daglig skribent om fodboldlivet i Spanien for engelsk The Guardian. Ham har jeg, Oscar Gomez Svendsen, taget en snak med. Vi håber, du vil lytte med, og så håber vi, at der ikke er alt for meget, der går tabt i oversættelsen. God lyttelyst. Hi, welcome, Sid. First of all, thanks a million for taking time out of a seemingly busy schedule, especially given that the Liga is back on full throttle now. I would expect that that your calendar all of a sudden got quite busy.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing, actually, how busy I've been even without football. It feels like the last 12, 13 weeks that there's been a lot going. From a journalistic point of view, we've had to be maybe that little bit more imaginative, had to make sure that we get to people to talk to people because there aren't games going on. So in that sense, although there's been no travelling, it does feel like it's been very busy. And yeah, as you say, with the games now, it accelerates even more. And so, for example, today I'm travelling for the first time in, wow, it must be the first time in 14 or 15 weeks. I'm in the car on the way to a game, which is a very strange feeling because it's been so long now.
Yeah, I can imagine. And you stayed in Madrid all this time as well, so you definitely had time to be creative, as you said, being locked up or locked down for 10 weeks or something like that.
Yeah, and it's been quite enjoyable in some ways to take a different view on things, to maybe find a way of getting people interested in some of the stories that under normal circumstances perhaps they wouldn't be. And, you know, put very bluntly, to be able to get pieces in the newspaper that maybe wouldn't normally find the space, you know, that wouldn't normally have the place that they've had during lockdown, and just be a bit more imaginative and do something a little different. That said, of course, you know, look, there's no doubt about it that the reason we do the job we do is because we like football. And so I've missed it. I've definitely missed the games. I've definitely missed the fact that there are games on. I still, because it's very early, of course, in the restart, there's still a slight sense of we don't know exactly how this is going to be, how it's going to feel to us. I was at Leganés at the weekend in an empty stadium, and it was a very strange experience. I mean, a very interesting one in some ways, and a very valuable one in some ways as well. But it's not quite the same. And so I'm looking forward to the league getting up and going properly, and really feeling like we're immersed in the football again.
Yes, I can definitely imagine. It's nice to have the thing that it's all about back in Spain as well, and knowing how important it is culturally as well in Spain. It gives a lot to the people, right? To have this thing and this thing to unite over that has certainly been missed for the last few months.
Yeah, I think that's true, and obviously, you know, a big part of what La Liga has said, and a big part of the kind of the whole discussion about bringing football back over the last few weeks has been that idea that you know, that one of the things that we need to do is get back to playing so that people have something else on their minds. I mean, I suppose in a way, the pity was that we couldn't get back to playing earlier when people were stuck at home. And now, of course, we're coming back to playing at a time when people are that little bit more able to get out, and maybe there are other things on their minds. But yeah, look, everybody's very happy to have it back. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, I can definitely imagine. So, but first things first, for those listeners who might be unaware of your credentials, let's start with the basics, maybe. Then noticing that you're renowned enough to have your own Wikipedia page, I suspect that it's edited and created by someone else, right?
Yeah. I've never had anything to do with it. I mean, there's been a few times when you know things turn up and they're wrong, and sometimes there is a temptation to say, well, maybe I should correct that, but of course, no, it kind of feels wrong to be involved in any way, and so no, it's nothing to do with me. I've never even given in to the temptation to edit mistakes.
No, that's probably good though. For me, at least, three things regarding you stand out. Your Spanish football, of course, which I can only highly recommend to everyone who enjoys Spanish football and not just Real Madrid. You do it every week, at least, with Phil Kitromelidis, and it's available on like all popular podcast apps, as well as you do some Patreon stuff as well. Then there's your famous book, Fear and Loathing in La Liga, which has a nice wordplay as well, of course, and then, of course, the work you do with The Guardian as well. I don't know if you think I'm missing something here on the list, other than, of course, you being a huge fan of Oviedo as well.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's something to be pleased about at the moment. The situation that Oviedo are in, it's not looking good, sadly, for Real Oviedo at the bottom, right near the bottom of the second division.
Yeah, exactly. They have seen better days. Let's put it like that, right?
That's for sure. That is for sure. Yeah.
So, but of course, what I would like to talk to you about today is a bit about the return of La Liga in general. I think we touched upon it a little bit, but let's dig a bit further into that that pile of stuff, and then of course how you perceive Real Madrid generally, and also at the current state, and I'm sure along that way a few other topics will pop up as well. And maybe we should also just add that you're sitting in a car in the north of Madrid, so if you're if the connection is a bit shakier, and if you're sometimes the sound might be a little bit off, then that's the reason that the reception north of north of Madrid in the hilly area is not always the best.
Not always the best. I've found somewhere now to pull over and stop. So hopefully we have a little bit of stability of sound for a little while.
Well, that's perfect. That's absolutely perfect. But I think you already touched a bit upon it. But this return of the Liga, in terms of Spanish cultural context, how much do you think it means in general in Spain to have this this focal point back to the people?
Well, I think in a way the answer to that question is the very fact that it's back, because bear in mind that, you know, this is a return that has been pushed very hard by Javier Tebas, the president of the league, but he's done so with the support of the Consejo Superior de Deportes, the CSD, which is essentially Spain's sports ministry. And Spain's sports ministry has kind of provided a bridge between La Liga and the health ministry, you know, trying to encourage the health ministry to agree to protocols in terms of protocols for returns to training, protocols for return to the matches, and to help push this through. Because I think that determination to push this through has obviously been about Tebas and his personality, but it was also been, I think, about a recognition from the government of the significance of La Liga. And so I think the very fact that La Liga is back is probably the best demonstration of the fact that it matters, or at least that it seemed to matter by the government. Now, that has been seen in some of the things that they've said. You know, listening to Pedro Sanchez, the Prime Minister, for example, when he announced that football could be back from the week beginning 8th of June, and he said that about 4 weeks ago or 5 weeks ago now. When he said it, he talked about it as an activity, if you like, of enormous cultural significance. I think that's shown. I think obviously the economic impact of Spanish football, and Tebas keeps on telling us, and he uses the same statistics every time, so I feel like they're burnt onto my brain now. You know, that football makes up, I think it's 1.38% of the country's GDP, that it accounts for directly and indirectly, and I suppose he probably includes my job in this, for 800,000 jobs. And so I think there is a sense that the very fact that it's back has been based on a recognition of its significance. And, you know, there are a couple of other examples of that. The fact that, for example, La Liga have agreed to have all of the games shown free in Spanish hospitals so that people can see them, and in care homes so that people can see them. So there is a sense of football playing a social role. Now, obviously, let's be honest about this, that has partly been exaggerated. And it's partly been exaggerated, of course, because what La Liga is really trying to do is protect its business. But it is true, I think, that it has a social significance. And it'll be very interesting to see. I think the first round of games, maybe not, but it'll be very interesting to see in 2 or 3 weeks' time what the television figures are like, and whether we do have a real sense of enormous numbers of people watching this, and maybe even more people than used to watch it.
Yeah, but what about the general perception by the people in Spain? I mean, if you take Barcelona and Madrid, they're in a different phase, a bit different return phase than the rest of Spain, to my knowledge, at least. Is it considered wise, or is it considered too soon, or what's the common common opinion towards having La Liga back already?
Yeah, I think that's a good question that doesn't have a very clear answer, because obviously there are different opinions for different people. I think earlier on, when Javier Tebas was so bullish about bringing the La Liga back, I think a lot of people felt this was unwise. I think a lot of people were worried about that. I think a lot of people felt that it showed perhaps a lack of sensitivity to the, you know, to the gravity of the situation. But I actually think that, of course, one of the things that Tebas had in his favour, and he's been proven right on this, and he, you know, he was talking about this last week in there was a conference call, a whole load of us international journalists talking to him, and he said, look, we had figures. You know, we had figures that we weren't publishing, but we were asking data analysts and epidemiologists to explain to us the progress of the pandemic and of the level of contagions and the level of deaths and so on. And so we knew that while we were pushing it at a time when it felt insensitive, by the time we got back, we knew that the figures would be coming down, that there would be a much more generalized sense of not normality, but something closer to normality in the country. So, for example, you know, we've now got terraces open outside bars. We've now got shops are opening again, albeit on minor capacity, at most 30%. And so La Liga has come back along with other cultural activities. It's not done it on its own. And as Tebas keeps saying, you know, we've only come back with half of what we do. With one half of what we do is a stadium full of fans, and the other half of what we do is watched on TV by fans. We can only do one of those two things. You know, we haven't got supporters in the stadiums yet. And so I think while some people are still uneasy about it, I think all the way through, people have been uneasy, for example, about the fact that footballers had, you know, three tests a week at a time when health workers didn't have tests. I think people were very uneasy about that. But as I say, as we've progressed, those things have felt less, if you like, less out of step with the rest of the country, you know. So it now feels like football's return is not a special thing for football. It feels much more like it's part of a generalised step towards normality. We're not at normality yet by any means, but a generalised step towards it.
Yeah, and also, I mean, you're born in England, and England definitely has a close relationship between people and cities and football clubs, and the same goes for Spain. But could you at least maybe, for our listeners, of course, are sitting in Denmark primarily, to try and outline some of the things that makes football maybe even more passionate and more important in Spain than compared to Northern Europe, you could say?
Well, I think, obviously, some of it is, and it's very difficult to avoid cliches here, but I mean, you know, let's use some of the cliches at least. I think there is something about national personality, about the way that Spaniards engage with each other, not just with football, you know, in terms of how they respond, in terms of the fact that statistics suggest, now whether this is true, I don't know, but it's one of those great myths that's always there. Statistics suggest that Spain is the noisiest country in Europe. I honestly don't know if that's true, but it sometimes feels like it when you hear. That, you know, this is a country that has, I think, a clearer sense of identification with place. And so, for example, Spaniards will always tell you where they're from, even if it's a little town. There's a very clear sense of community, I think, which has been eroded in the last 15 or 20 years because, like anywhere, Spanish society is shifting, it's evolving, it's become atomized, fragmented in some ways. But I think those things are still there. And then, obviously, with Spain, there are other elements. So there are elements like, for example, the degree of identification with regions, not just because it's your home, but also because of there are separate identities. So you know, the obvious example here are the Basque clubs and Barcelona with their identification with Catalonia and the Basque country. But I think it's true of Galician clubs. I think it's true of a lot of clubs in Andalusia. I think it's true of Real Madrid as well, despite the fact that Real Madrid, in a way, are a kind of a pan-Spanish club. And obviously, they're now even more than that. They're now a universal club, you know, a worldwide club. But I think in terms of its identification, it's almost, if you like, it's the whole country's team in a way. But I think those kind of elements change how people respond to Spanish football. I think as well, Spain, and again, there is a risk of falling into cliche with this, but, you know, Spain is the country of fiestas. It's the country of if you like, local pride. It's the country of if you like, external expressions of who you are. And so I think all of that feeds into the football. Now, again, there is a risk of falling into cliche, and I think at times, and I include myself in this, by the way, I think at times we do accept the cliches perhaps too easily. But definitely Spain is a country where football plays a really central role in the culture of the country.
Yeah, definitely. Also, I mean, if I understood you correctly, you said you went to Butaque on... When was that?
On Saturday night.
Saturday night, for Lega home against Valladolid. How was that feeling? I mean, one thing is seeing it on TV and you see the computer-generated fans in the stands and you have the artificial noise and so on, but what's it like being in that empty stadium?
Very strange. I mean, there are a lot of things that really struck me, and obviously, look, one of them is just how quiet it is. The other thing is that, I mean, there were lots of things, but as I say, one of the other key things for me was that when you sit and watch a football game in those conditions, the kind of things that the players say, the noise, the shouting, it feels very familiar. It doesn't feel enormously different to a park game. You know, you can hear the shouts, you can hear people saying, push up, man on, hold, wait, make the tackle, get there, don't dive in, you know, that sort of stuff. Those kind of commands, which are, I think, universal, and they're everywhere. Yeah. There are other sounds that are different. So, for example, this may sound foolish, but I was really struck by the noise of the ball, how hard it sounds, how hard they kick it, how clean the contact is. You know, I was speaking, funny enough, to Graham Lassow, who's now a director at Mallorca, of course, a former England left-back, and he said he played tennis with Andy Kohlberg, and Andy Kohlberg is the president of Mallorca, but also a former tennis player. And he said something about playing tennis with him, and he said, you know, I think I play tennis, but the noise that a professional makes when he hits the ball is different. And actually the same is true in football. The noise, the cleanness of the contact, how fast the ball moves is different. The other thing that I noticed with the noises was the kind of the thud of footsteps on the floor. It makes the floor sound very hard. It gives you an impression, I think, of the athleticism of some of the players. And so you get this thing that makes it sound like any football game, which is the shouting and the kind of the calls and the commands. But then you get this slight difference in the noise. And you can almost hear different kinds of passes by the sound of the contact on the ball. And there are other things that really struck me. One, for example, was hearing the birds sing. I mean, genuinely sitting in the stands, I can hear the birds sing during the game, which was a really, I mean, it doesn't really matter and it's not a big deal, but it really reached me. It really made me think, okay, we're in a totally different environment now. And then there were things to do with football which I thought were interesting. And probably the most interesting thing I thought to do with the football was the fact that at the moment, because of the pandemic, every team is allowed to have all of their substitutes on the subs bench, right? So there's 12 substitutes for each team. Now, of course, they don't sit on the subs bench. They sit in the stands because the subs bench isn't big enough and because they have to be socially distanced. So I was sitting just behind the Leganés players because it's not such a big stadium. And the Leganés players are sitting in the stands, three or four seats apart, all of them, and there's 12 of them. And the same was true of the Valladolid players who were further to the left from where I was sitting. And those players seemed to have decided that they were going to play a role, that they were going to clap and shout and cheer and appeal and shout at the referee. And almost as if, right, we're going to be the fans today. Now, we're going to try and fill that gap. And it was really, really interesting to see it because it felt to me not like 12 guys who got involved in the game as the game went on. It felt like to me like 12 guys whose job was to do this. You know, this was a deliberate policy. We are going to try and create some of the conditions that a football match needs.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, and also I think now you're mentioning fans. I think that's actually another question I wanted to ask you about is in Denmark, which of course I know is quite different compared to both the UK and Spain for that matter. We have had so far around 600 people dead total of the COVID-19. In Spain it's looking a lot more grave, but in Denmark they have started opening up for bringing groups of 500 to 700 people back into the stands in Denmark for the matches, season ticket holders and so on. Do you know if Spain has had any discussions or anything in relation to doing somewhat the same?
Yes, they have. Javier Tebas said he's hopeful that from July, because at the start of July, in theory at least, every province in Spain will be in phase three of the government's process of de-escalation, in other words, the process of a return towards normality. And once everyone is in phase three, then in theory there can be a return to spectator events, not necessarily football. It's part of the protocol. Cinemas and so on. And so La Liga is hopeful that they can maybe get some fans back in, perhaps 10 or 15%. Obviously, there will be social distancing. But there are question marks, of course, because the social distancing in the stadium is one thing, but fans have to get to the stadium. So what about trains? Mm. What about metros, buses, and so on? So there's doubts about that. But this all happened because 2 weeks ago, the president of Las Palmas said, well, Las Palmas in the Canary Islands, of course, is in phase three. In phase three, it's the local health authorities that decide. And so I'm going to propose a protocol to them to allow our fans in. Now, obviously, all the other clubs said, whoa, hang on a minute. Either everybody has to be allowed fans in or none of us should be. There has to be a competition question here. And the CSD, the Consejo Superior de Deportes, as I say, effectively the sports ministry, a governmental body that looks after sport in Spain, said, yeah, we think everyone should be allowed in or no one should be allowed in. But actually, Tebas is in favour of fans being allowed in when they can be. And this has caused a bit of an argument because, for example, Levante have left the city of Valencia. They're playing 150 kilometres away.
Yeah.
So they're saying, well, we did this because we thought there'd be no fans left in. And you're now going to say, well, fans can come in. But we've moved grounds now. And what are we going to do? Bus fans 150 kilometres away to a tiny stadium, by the way, so they won't be getting many in. And, of course, Real Madrid are in a similar position.
Yes.
Because Real Madrid have moved from the Bernabeu to Valdebebas. And so if you take, okay, 10% of fans can go to the Bernabeu, you're talking about 7,500 fans, nearly 8,000 fans. If you say 10% of fans can go to Valdebebas, you're talking about less than 1,000.
Yeah.
About around about 650, maybe slightly less even than that. And so Real Madrid is saying, but so this isn't fair. And we did this because you said that there would be no fans at all this season. So we said, right, let's go on with the work at the Bernabeu. Let's accelerate the work there and see this season out. Now, obviously, they're both right. Levante and Real Madrid are both completely right about this, and Osasuna have complained as well because they're also doing works. But I suppose there is a little bit of me that thinks, yeah, but during the season, different clubs have different sized stadiums anyway. So, I mean, it's not necessarily a huge leap. I think, for me, and I must admit, I see this from a fan's point of view. For me, I would like, if it's safe, to see as many fans as possible back in the stadium as soon as possible, even if it means that some clubs can only have 600 and some clubs can have maybe 6,000. But I recognise that it is problematic. It is difficult to find a solution that is happy for everyone. And in fact, it's impossible to find a solution that everyone's going to be happy with. But there is a chance now. I think it would be very small numbers, but there is a chance now. But it wouldn't happen until July. But of course, because we're playing so many games at the moment, if you get fans in at the start of July, we could be looking at five rounds of matches worth. So it's quite significant.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And there's also another thing that in relation to the games that I wanted to ask you about, Sid. When you sit in cold, cozy Scandinavia like I do, it's very difficult for us to imagine the weather and the power of the sun in Spain during late June and July. So two questions here. I mean, how big of an impact will that have in general in terms of the results and the games we'll see for the remainder of the league, of the season, of course? And also, does that favour any clubs more than others, you think?
Well, look, Spain has been very lucky so far. This first round of games, we've not had typical summer temperatures. It's been very, very, very mild so far. It will have an enormous impact at some point. This is the reason why so many games are kicking off at 10 o'clock at night, because, of course, they're trying to avoid the hottest hours of the day. And if you look at the fixture list, it's very clear. The 2 o'clock kickoffs and the 5 o'clock kickoffs, where they happen, are all in the north. And any games in the south are played later. That's natural. Whether this will be of an advantage to any teams, I suppose logic would suggest that maybe it's advantageous to the teams in the south because they're more used to it, and because they will always have 10 o'clock kickoff time, so they won't have to switch between times, except, of course, when they play away from home. But it might well be that it helps the teams in the north, because they're the ones who will play more games in better temperatures, in cooler temperatures. I honestly don't know the answer. I mean, I think that logic suggests what we will see is slower games. But so far that hasn't happened, as I say, in part because we really haven't had the kind of temperatures we normally have at this time of year. Not yet.
No. That's true. So, and also when we talk about the finishing of the league, I think a question that's in everyone's mind, of course, is who do you consider to be the favorites in the title race? Is it Barcelona? Is it Madrid? And what speaks in favor of each club, if there are any favors at the moment?
It's very difficult to know for sure if there are any favors. I think maybe we saw a slight glimpse of it when Real Madrid played Eibar, which is to say that I personally think Madrid have much more depth in their squad. I think they have more quality on the bench. I think the difference between the players who start and the players who can come on is not so great. I think Real Madrid don't really have a player that they absolutely can't live without, whereas Barcelona, of course, do with Messi. Funnily enough, if Madrid do have a player they can't live without, it's probably Casemiro, who's not the most creative, but he's the one who doesn't have a replacement or a natural replacement. I think, obviously, Real Madrid would suffer a lot without Benzema, but I think there's so much quality there that they can play around with that. And I think Zidane will. And I think we saw this against Eibar, didn't we, that you get to 60 minutes and the game is basically done and you make lots of changes and you try and protect players. And I've been surprised that one of those players hasn't been Casemiro so far, just as I've been surprised that with Barcelona, one of those players hasn't been Messi. So, at the moment, I feel like probably Real Madrid are better equipped to play 11 games in 5 weeks, probably. Obviously, Barcelona have that slight advantage in that they're 2 points clear, but of course it's 2 points clear with a head-to-head record being Real Madrid's advantage because of the Clásico results. I feel like a big part of the answer to this question is, does Messi stay fit for all 11 games?
Yeah.
And I know it's ridiculous in a way to be reducing it to one player, but I feel like that's it. And not least, of course, because we know that Luis Suarez isn't fully fit. Of course, we know that Eden Hazard isn't fully fit, but I think he looks fitter than Suarez does at the moment. And I think that, you know, when you've got Rodrigo and Vinicius and Bale and even, you know, even Brahim, even Marco Asensio, who we're not sure quite how fit he's going to be, but his return, and I'm really pleased on a personal level for him, because I mean, you know, he's a wonderful player who's had such bad luck, and I'd really love him to play at least some minutes between now and the season, maybe even play some full games. But I kind of feel like Real Madrid are better equipped for this slightly strange scenario than Barcelona are. But there are so many doubts at the moment that it's really difficult to give an answer.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think it's, like you also said before, I think we'll see games that are, and teams that are reacting and playing very different from round to round, simply because it's so compact at the moment, right? So if we are to dig a little bit into Real Madrid, and now you mentioned one of the players that I think could be potentially interesting to talk about this summer as well, when the season at some point is over, is of course Gareth Bale. And you as a Brit, of course, probably have a more insight than what we do. But I remember reading a piece from you in The Guardian about Gareth Bale right after what we could call the flag incident, the Wales, Gulf, Madrid, and that order, where you stated that Bale knew that it would cause for unhappy reactions in Madrid. And maybe if in building on top of that, what is your take in terms of his satisfaction in Madrid? And here I'm not necessarily talking the golf courses or the salary, but in general, also being in Real Madrid, do you think he's content? Is he looking to move? What's your thoughts on him?
Right. Well, the situation with Gareth in a way is quite simple in that he's not happy with the way things are. If the move was the right one, he would take it. I mean, you know, we saw, for example, last year, and we shouldn't forget this, but he was on the verge of going to China, and that deal only really broke down because Real Madrid had been beaten by Atletico in the summer. That increased the pressure on them. That made them doubt whether it was the right thing to do, and also made them think, by the way, that perhaps they could leverage some more money out of Chinese clubs, which, of course, wasn't the case in the end because they weren't prepared to pay that money and continue to pay Gareth Bale the size of salary that he was being offered. I think it's amazing, really. I think it's remarkable that a player like Bale, still as young as Bale, was prepared to go to China. And I must admit, I think it's slightly disappointing that he was prepared to go to China. But he was. So the question is, really, is how do you find an exit strategy that is to everyone's satisfaction? You know, how do you find... And Real Madrid thought that they had that last year. And in particular, Bale's representatives thought that they had that. You know, this is a club that's not a rival to Real Madrid. So you can move him on. And there isn't that risk for Real Madrid of, yeah, but what happens if he comes against us in the Champions League and plays well, and then that hurts us in terms of what the fans think about the decision. Politically, maybe it's not a great idea. You can take him to China and no one cares what happens after that. And so it was a good deal in some ways for Madrid, but it didn't happen. This summer, I think, a similar situation, but this summer is harder because, of course, there's going to be less money on the market. You know, Gareth is not particularly keen on the idea of going back to England. He's not particularly keen on the idea of if you like, of kind of going, of remaining in this kind of circle. And so there's this slightly strange situation at the moment, whereas he's actually quite happy living in Spain. But the relationship with Madrid is just, I wouldn't say it was broken as such. It's just cold. It's just, there isn't really one. You know, it's just like everyone just kind of gets on with it. And, you know, this isn't ideal, but we carry on because to use that Spanish phrase, it's lo que hay. You know, it is what it is. It's the situation. It's just where we're at. And it's not really good for anybody. And yet, of course, it can only be changed if someone finds a sufficiently attractive exit strategy for everybody. And to be honest with you, at the moment, I don't think that exit strategy exists.
No, it's probably difficult to also see a club willing to spend that amount of money on Gao that as well, right? Unless they're getting him for free.
That is the key here. So the key really is that when you're on the kind of salary that Gareth Bale is on, when you're at a club like Real Madrid, which would expect to recover some money for him, but I think probably will have to accept that they can't, and maybe they'll decide that the loss in wages is sufficient to mean, well, you know, he can go now for not very much or for free, and actually he's been at the club for, what would it be, 6 years. You know, this guy's won 4 European Cups, by the way, so yeah. It's not like it's been a bad signing by any means. And so while it feels, and this is one of the other difficult things with Gareth's situation, is it feels bad, but actually he's been a hugely successful signing. So I think you can, you know, you can find a solution and sort of say, well, you know, this was all right. It wasn't perfect, but it was all right. But yeah, that's exactly it. As I say, I mean, that's what I mean by the exit strategy. How do you find a club who's prepared to pay for him? How do you find a club that's prepared to pay him his wages? How do you find a club that Real Madrid are prepared to let him go to? And how do you find a club that Gareth Bale wants to go and play for? And those are four elements: salary, transfer fee, Real Madrid, Gareth Bale. And it's really difficult to find a deal that satisfies those four elements. In fact, I would honestly, at the moment, I think it's impossible.
Yeah, I would imagine so as well. And also, I mean, do you know how well he perceived he is? One thing is the relationship with the club, as you mentioned, that's cold. But what about internally in the squad? Is that also a cold relationship, or does he actually have friends? Is probably a bad word to use here, but at least people to lean on.
Yes, I mean, you know, his relationship is good with Luka Modric. His relationship is good with Toni Kroos. Obviously, there is a language element to this. And there have been periods in his career when he's been closer to the others. I mean, there was a period where I think he felt like he'd become closer to Sergio Ramos, in part, of course, because Modric and Ramos are very close. But I think what happened with Gareth is that there came a point at which, and by the way, he gets on well again. I think there's a language element to this. He gets on well with Eden Hazard. And actually, at the start of the summer, there was a suggestion from some people within the club that maybe Hazard would help, which is bizarre, really, because Hazard's the new arrival. But maybe Hazard would help to bring Bale kind of back in. The situation now is that I don't think there's anybody who dislikes Bale, but I think within the squad. But I think there are people who sort of think that Bale has kind of checked out, you know? Bale has sort of drifted away from it. He's almost a, what would you call it? I suppose a piece that doesn't entirely fit, that's not a problem.
Okay, yeah.
And he absolutely isn't a problem. It just sort of not quite there. Obviously, Zidane and Bale's relationship has been cold for a while, but they both get on with it. I think the question mark quite often in these situations is, where does Florentino sit in this? And of course, Florentino changes his mind from time to time. Yeah. And because you know, like anyone, he sees things and he thinks, oh, this is recoverable, then decides it's not. I think, for example, you know, you see sometimes articles in the paper say Bale and Zidane's relationship is broken and there's been a big falling out. Actually, in truth, there isn't a falling out as such. It's more just that there's just a kind of sense of maybe there isn't a way back here. And I think often those kind of stories come more from the president and more from, if you like, boardroom level, the surroundings of the club, than they come directly from the manager and the player. Because in a way, both the manager and the player have kind of assimilated this situation now. You know, they know what it is and they just get on with it. And it's not good for anybody, but it's not so bad as to, if you like, to force a confrontation or to force them into a position where they think, ah, we absolutely must fix this now. It would be better if he went, yes, but everybody knows that him going isn't great, isn't easy to do, rather.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And also you could say, and that maybe leads me to the next question I have for you, is also in terms of the transfer strategy, if we were to look a bit at that in a Real Madrid context. It seems that it has shifted over the course of the last few years. Of course, you could argue that Hazard is a big name signing, and I wouldn't have any counter arguments to you on that one. But apart from that, it seems the strategy has shifted into bringing in younger and younger players, talent, you could say, more than rather than established players. Do you think that is because La Fabrica is not producing as it's supposed to? Is it a matter of realizing that these established players have become too expensive, or is it simply just, is it something else from Florentino Pérez? Is it lack of money, maybe?
I think that's it. I mean, look, it is lack of money. I mean, let's put this into context. It's not lack of money in the sense, oh my God, Real Madrid are broke. They're absolutely not broke. But it is about a recognition of, if you like, the new reality, right? Mm. So it's about an awareness that now, even a club like Real Madrid, at certain points in the transfer market, can't compete with what Tebas always refers to as state clubs. You know, can't compete with Paris Saint-Germain and Man City, and actually can't compete with quite a lot of Premier League clubs as well. And so, for example, you said that the counter-argument is Hazard, which on one level it is, but in a way it's not. Because, of course, the reason that Hazard came when he came instead of 2 years earlier was price. You know, 2 years earlier, you couldn't get him for that price, and he came at the price he came for one very simple reason. His price had dropped, you know, because it was in the last year of his contract. And in a way, Madrid spent quite a lot of money for a player who was in the last year of his contract. But that's why they had to wait. And so you look at the signings since then, and it's about buying the person who will be the best player in the world rather than maybe the person who is the best player in the world already. So I think that's part of it. It's about an economic realization, you know, a reality. But it's also, I think, as well, about something to do with the reality of the market in Spain, which is that, I don't know about you, and however strong the Premier League gets, I still look at the world football market and I think that with three or four really big exceptions, and of course those are the ones that Real Madrid are interested in, so like, for example, Neymar or Mbappe, the very best players in the world still play in Spain. So, A, you can't afford them, and B, who are the best players? Well, you've got most of them, and the ones you haven't got, Barcelona have got, so you're not going to get them. And so it's about a shift in the market. It's an economic element, an economic thing. And it also tells you, I think, something about, if you like, a focus. And the focus can be seen in particular in terms of the increasing significance of Juni Calafat, who has been doing the scouting for Real Madrid in Brazil. And that awareness, you say, right, and obviously Rodrigo is an example of this, Rainier is an example of this, Vinicius is an example of this. Right, let's go and buy these players who are going to be the best in the world. And by the way, Madrid have spent a lot of money on players that are very young. But of course, the strategy is very simple. Vinicius comes for 45 million. Is that too much for an 18-year-old? Yes. There's no doubt about it. It's too much for an 18-year-old. But is it too much for a guy who, when he's 23, could be a Ballon d'Or winner? No way. It's cheap.
No.
So what Madrid are doing, in a way, is they're taking slightly more of a risk to get players slightly cheaper by going for them slightly earlier.
Yeah.
And that is the fundamental change in what Real Madrid are doing now. It's about the timing and it's about the price.
So you think also this shift with South American players, is that in relation to Perez thinking this new strategy? Is it actually Juni Calafat who's so powerful that he has convinced the president that this is the way to go forward?
I'm not sure if I would necessarily use the word powerful, but he's certainly becoming more significant. And I think the fact that they're, you know, it's very early to say this, but personally, I watch Rodrigo and I think there's a very, very, very good player there. I watch Vinicius and I think maybe not quite as technically gifted as Rodrigo, but potentially a very, very good player there as well. And so the early signs are that these signings can work. And of course, the other one, and this isn't Brazil, but the other one is Ødegaard, who we all had our doubts about, and it's taken a long time to get to this point, but we forget that he joined the club at 16. But you watch Ødegaard now at Real Sociedad, I think Ødegaard's been the best or the second best player in Spain this season.
Yeah.
And he's a Real Madrid player, and he might play for Real Madrid next year, he might play for them in 2 years' time. But he is brilliant, and I think what that's done is it's strengthened Real Madrid's resolve, and it's strengthened their feeling that, yes, this can work. Because I think a little while ago, we'd have all been thinking, maybe this doesn't work. Maybe this doesn't work because, you know, for example, with Ødegaard, there are a lot of people being very critical because, of course, he left the club. It didn't work very well at Castilla. Say, well, he played well, but it was only in Holland. And so I think that his performances this season, I think those brief moments from Vinicius and from Rodrigo, for all the doubts about Vinicius, and there are doubts, obviously, about him in terms of finishing and so on, I think that actually makes Real Madrid believe that this could work. And in the worst case scenario, all right, these players leave. And maybe for Vinicius one day, imagine Vinicius fails. Imagine he doesn't keep developing. Mm. Imagine he turns out to not be that good. The chances are they're still going to get 20 or 30 million for him from someone.
Yeah.
And so maybe that money will be covered. And so I think it's about strategy. But yeah, you were right with the very first point in this. It's a strategy based on an awareness of an economic reality.
Yeah. That's definitely true. Does that also mean, in your opinion, that the thought of bringing Kylian Mbappé to Madrid is more a media spin than it's something that's actually rooted in reality? Because if you read Spanish newspapers, it seems like, you know, it's más cerca, it's a close deal, right?
Well, I mean, this is the thing. The situation with Mbappé, in a way, is very clear, but unfortunately that clarity doesn't happen yet, if you see what I mean. So it's very clear that Real Madrid wants him. It's very clear that Real Madrid strategically think he is the player for 10 years at the club, because, you know, he's been around for a while now, but he's still very young. You know, you buy him, even if it takes you two more years to buy him, you're still getting a decade out of him. And by the way, let me just sort of say at this point, it's been a decade of Benzema, and it doesn't feel like it, does it? And no. I actually think Benzema, while it's true that he hasn't been the goal scorer that Ronaldo was, or even the goal scorer that, say, Luis Suarez is at Barcelona, you know, there is value in getting someone who can be there for 10 years. And Benzema was expensive when he came. You look at him now, that wasn't expensive at all. With Mbappe, there's no doubt that he's a strategic signing for the future from Real Madrid's point of view. That they believe that he wants to come. That they believe that the decision to go to Paris Saint-Germain was very much about structuring and building a career, and there was enough time to do that and still come to Real Madrid, right? So, and of course, make no mistake, if Real Madrid believe this, it's because they are talking to his people. And it's because those people are saying to Real Madrid that, yes, there's a chance. But, of course, they also know that his people will be talking to other clubs. That his people will certainly be talking to Paris Saint-Germain, who will be offering him the world to stay. And maybe at some point he will think, actually, this is the right decision. So the situation, in a way, is that now what they're at, the position that Real Madrid are at now, is that they depend on this reaching a point at which the balance of power shifts between them and Paris Saint-Germain. And that can only happen based on the contractual situation that Mbappé is in. And so, in other words, they need to rely on Mbappé having the nerve, having the courage, and having the determination to resist Paris Saint-Germain's attempts to extend his contract, so that effectively can force Paris Saint-Germain into a position a bit like Chelsea were in with Eden Hazard, where they effectively admit defeat and say, OK, we'll take some money while we can. And therefore, of course, the price comes down, the willingness to sell goes up, and hopefully then, from Real Madrid's point of view, they can get him. But that is still not 100% in their hands. They are trying to make the conditions for that to happen. How do they do that? By telling Mbappé, don't renew. We're coming for you. We're absolutely certain. And by the way, I mean, I don't know this, and I'm purely speculating, but in a situation like this, what often happens, of course, is that the player and the buying club sign some kind of confidential pre-agreement, which effectively forces that player to not let the club down when the time comes.
Yeah. Could very well be. Also talking about some of the young talents, you mentioned Ødegaard before. He has another year to see that, I suppose. Then also a guy like Kubu. How many of the players on loan do you think would be fit for Real Madrid to bring back, and maybe even bring back a certain goalkeeper from the lower part of the second division?
I mean, by the way, I've liked the look of Looney, and I think he's a little bit erratic still, but that's to be expected because he's young, but I'd like the look of him. I think they will try and bring loan players back, particularly because of the situation with the market, and I think clubs will bring loan players back. But, of course, you're looking at a lot of loan players. Certainly, if you look at it from the point of view of Kubo, you look at it from the point of view of Ødegaard, and of course, Brahim, who didn't go out on loan but is at the club and was one of those players who might have gone out on loan. And you think, this is a lot of players for the same position. So you have a difficulty there, and specifically in the case of Ødegaard, and I think Ødegaard's case is very, very interesting, because, of course, the plan was 2 years, and Ødegaard's plan is 2 years, and Ødegaard doesn't want to come back yet, and it's not because he doesn't want to go to Real Madrid, he absolutely does, but it's because he wants the continuity, and he wants to come back to Real Madrid at that point at which he's the finished article. And I think there would be a doubt now from Real Madrid, because they've seen him, and they think, well, he's a finished article already, he's brilliant already, we want him now. And Ødegaard must have a temptation to say, I want to go to Real Madrid now. But at the same time, he knows, and he's clearly very bright, by the way, very sensible, it's clearly very well advised by his father. And I think that he will still think, maybe I wait. And I, you know, I personally, seen from Ødegaard's point of view, I hope he doesn't come back yet. Because I want him to be somewhere where he plays every game, and so that when he comes back, he really does play every match. Now, that's a difficult thing to ask for from Real Madrid, because they're such a big club with so many good players. And I think Madrid have to be very, very careful about how they plan what they do with loan players.
Yeah, definitely. And also you could argue, I mean, that was probably the same question we had last summer, right, with names such as Ramos, Isco, Ceballos for that matter. What to do with them?
I really don't know. And I think with, you look, for example, at Ceballos at Arsenal, and he started very well, but he's drifted a bit. Has Dani Ceballos really done enough for Real Madrid to think, yeah, he can work in the middle of our midfield? He can play the Modric role or the Kroos role or, by the way, the Odegaard role. You know, so you've got to look at whether or not he comes back into the team, but also who else is coming back? You know, who else is there to play those positions? You know, Valverde has changed the shape of Madrid's midfield this year. So how do you fit someone like Ceballos with someone like Valverde, perhaps? Then you look at Isco, who Isco has been a really good player at Real Madrid, but maybe not as dominant as he might have been, partly because, of course, Isco's natural role is a number 10, and Madrid have had a formation, for the most part, that doesn't fit a number 10. And when Isco has played best, it's when they've shifted that formation. So the year that Madrid won the league and the Champions League, and Isco was wonderful for the last, what was it, four months of the season, it was when they took Bale out of the team and played a 4-3-1-2, and Isco had the freedom to move around. And then you say, well, to get the best out of him, where do we put him? How do we structure this team? How do we make this work? And then you've mentioned James. I find James a very difficult one to get my head around, because James is one of those players, it seems to me, that for whatever reason doesn't entirely fit the system. For whatever reason, Zidane doesn't seem entirely convinced either, and I think that's a key element here. And he's one of those players, I always feel, James, that doesn't dominate games, but he does decide a lot of them. Because he produces two or three brilliant crosses every match, and those are half, those are a goal in waiting. Again, to go back to that season when Real Madrid won the league and the Champions League, and they rotated the team, particularly in the away games, for all of the last, what was it, 6, 7, 8 weeks. You know, in every game they played away, it was a whole new team. And that whole new team was Morata and James, basically, plus some others. And those two played really, really well. And yet, deep down, you knew they were playing well because of this rotation policy. So how can you put them in the first team? And I think with James, my doubt with James is, a bit like with Bale, what's the exit strategy? If you decide that the best thing to do is to move him on, where do you take him? What price do you accept? Where does he want to go? And I don't know the answers to those questions. And again, a bit like Bale, last summer, of course, it was done to Atletico Madrid. It was all set up. And then Real Madrid were in a position where they thought, it doesn't look good. This pre-season hasn't gone well. This is a decision that could come back and bite us. And so there was a nervousness about it, which, by the way, I think is understandable, but it was there. And so I think James is the kind of player that I think Madrid have to look for an exit for him. But I don't know what that exit is.
Oh, it's the same as a lot of other players, I think you could easily argue, right? On a final note, Sid, when you look at the Real Madrid, say, on a longer time frame, not just next season. One of the things that seems pretty evident, at least, is that Florentino Perez is more and more defining Real Madrid, and you could argue that he has become a new Santiago Bernabeu in certain matters, at least. Do you think it's for him alone to decide when his reign is over, or do you think it's actually possible for anyone to run a true candidacy against him?
No, I think running a genuine opposition candidacy against Florentino is almost impossible. Obviously we know the criteria in terms of the amount of money that has to be put up as an aval, what you call that in English, a guarantee, to ensure that the club has no financial difficulties. And that's, by the way, a governmental rule. It's not really about the club's rules. It's a governmental rule about guaranteeing, I think it's 10% of the budget. So in other words, you're looking at 95 million euros that has to be guaranteed. What Florentino did change, which makes it far more difficult, is that has to be a personal guarantee now. So, you can't generate that money for a consortium or for a bank loan. It has to be personal guarantee, which means obviously very, very few people can stand. The increase in the years probably isn't a major problem, but you have to be Spanish, you have to have been on the board, I think it's 20 years, it might even be 25 now, I think it's 20. And so I think it's very, very difficult. I also think it's very difficult for a very simple reason, which is that very few people are going to want to run, knowing that they would probably... because Florentino Perez certainly has his detractors there, and there's some people who have some doubts about the way he manages the club. But I think the immense majority of the people, even when there are some elements of the club's management that they maybe are doubtful about, would still look at Florentino Perez and say, you know, this club is, in business terms, hyper-professional, incredibly stable, very, very strong financially, has in sporting terms, of course, been hugely successful. And it's curious in a way, because obviously, domestically, Real Madrid have actually been really poor for a decade now. But maybe that's because the Messi era has been so dominant for a decade domestically. But their European success is so gigantic that I don't think anyone can look at this and say it's been anything other than successful. As I say, I think in terms of continuity and in terms of the week in, week out, perhaps you can have some doubts. But, you know, this is a team that won three European Cups in a row. I mean, it's mind-blowing. It really is mind-blowing. And so I don't think anyone can really stand against Florentino, A, because of the criteria, B, because of the cost, C, because of the results. And so in terms of what happens after Florentino, I guess, you know, there is that question, as you say. I think it does depend on him. And then I honestly don't know what his thinking will be. You know, he walked away once in 2006, I think it was, and he hoped that he would have at least a hand in the club in terms of the people that followed him would be people who would be supportive of him, there would be people who would follow his model. And of course what happened was that one of them, Ramon Calderon, and we sometimes forget this because Ramon Calderon is now Florentino's sworn enemy, but he was a board member with Florentino. You know, there was a sense that this is the guy that will be continuity, but he wasn't. And in personality terms, they're very, very different. And actually, Ramon Calderon, I think, was no match for Florentino in terms of intelligence, in terms of political awareness, in terms of his manoeuvrability at the club. And I think Calderon was possibly quite naive in some of the things that he did. And I think it made it too easy for when the time came for him to be, if you like, kind of pushed to the side. Florentino came back. And in a way, I think Florentino probably thinks that the big mistake he made wasn't what he did at Real Madrid. It was leaving. You know, and so when he came back, right, there was a determination not to repeat some of the errors, but one of the errors he was determined not to repeat was, I won't walk away again, not if the future isn't secure, and I would say, obviously, a future in his vision of the club. And so I think what will probably happen will be that Florentino will be thinking carefully right now about what happens if I walk away, who runs this club, who manages it, what will my role be, will it be nothing at all, will I have some sort of role? And I honestly don't know what he's thinking about that. And there's a little bit of me that thinks maybe he just carries on forever now until obviously the day in which he passes away. I genuinely don't know, but I think the way you framed the question was right in that I think the future at an organisational and institutional level depends on what Florentino wants it to be.
Yeah. And now that you're talking about someone who has done a lot and won a lot of trophies for the club, Does the same go for Zidane, you think? Is he also there until he wants to leave himself? Or is that a bit of a different story, maybe?
Yeah, I think it's a different story because, of course, he doesn't have the degree of, if you like, structural power that Florentino has. I think he has emotional power, there's no doubt about it. You know, this is a guy that is untouchable in many ways. But he doesn't have the structural protection. And, of course, Zidane is someone who knows that if results were awful, then I suppose he could be sacked. But it's very difficult to sack him now, particularly because of the way that he came back, and that was seen as a favour, not just to the club, but to the man who brought him to the club, Florentino, to the president, to, if you like, to the people at the club. And it was seen, I think, in a way of, right, I come back because I owe it to you personally. Admittedly, of course, he came back with renewed powers. You know, he came back on a promise. We will do this for you. We'll move this player on. We'll bring this player in. We'll do that. We'll make some of these things work for you that you were worried about they didn't work before. And, of course, Zidane came back much more powerful than he left, even though he left with three European Cups. But he came back with three European Cups and a disaster at the club without him. And so his position was much, much strengthened. But, of course, he also knows that if things were to go disastrously wrong, yeah, he would eventually be sacked like other men have been. But it would take a lot more to sack Zidane. You know, sacking Benitez was easy. Sacking Solari was easy. Sacking Zidane is not easy. But I think his future, under normal circumstances, will depend on him. But I think it fundamentally depends on results like anything. I also wonder, and again, this is just an interpretation because Zidane is very difficult to judge, whether he now, having come back the way he came back, might be in a position where he kind of can't walk away again because he's already walked away once before. And if for him to walk away again, he will have to walk away in a scenario in which I think it's agreed with the club and in which his successor is set up. Now, of course, we all know that the long-term or medium-term plan for Real Madrid, if things go well and if he proves himself, is Zidane succeeds and then Raul takes over.
Yeah.
That's the perfect scenario. Whether or not that can happen, obviously, will depend on success and results and so on.
Yeah, and that also leads to maybe it's time to include Raul somehow in the first team as well, just like Zidane did under Ancelotti.
Possibly. And in a way, you know, Zidane's arrival as first team manager was very smooth because he'd had that experience with Ancelotti, because he'd had that experience at Castilla. But of course, it also happened at an unexpected time. It happened in January with a sacking that we weren't necessarily anticipating. Although obviously by then I think we all were anticipating it. And Florentino hadn't wanted to do that yet. You know, that was in a way the last roll of the dice. You know, there was a reason why he hadn't gone to Zidane in the summer. And it was because he wasn't sure. And the truth is, of course, that when they put Zidane in place, quite naturally they weren't sure. But yeah, then it went so well that from that moment on, of course, everybody's sure.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I'll leave you to it, Sid. I know you have a lot of intensive days coming up, and I know there's a lot of games and a lot of things for you to do. But just as a final question, what are you looking most forward to here over the course of the next month?
I honestly, you know, because in a way, so much of what I enjoy about football is the sense of occasion. So, for example, the obvious answer to this question would be the Copa del Rey final between Real Sociedad and Athletic Bilbao, for example. Or, you know, the day that Atletico and Barcelona face each other and the impact that may have on the league. Or that final day of the season where everything is intertwined and it means so much to so many people. But because of the scenario we're in, and in particular, as I say, because for me a lot of it is about the way that people live it and the experience and the sense around the games of why this matters, you know, what this means. There's a bit of me that thinks, I don't actually know if I'm going to enjoy this in the way that I normally would. And so I kind of don't know what I'm looking forward to. I suppose what I am looking forward to probably still is that final day and that hope that there is a lot still in play, that there is a sense of a big occasion, there's a sense that it matters. But I must admit, I do feel like this is a season that will always have a little asterisk by it, a little star. And it'll be, you know, that season that sort of wasn't. You know, that season that sort of wasn't real. And so I guess the answer, at the risk of giving you a cliched answer, is what I'm hoping for and what I'm looking forward to is that moment in which we all feel like this is good again. You know, like this is us again. This is what we love about football. This is maybe some fans in the stadium, maybe some sense that we've come through it now and that we can start... I guess we can start living and enjoying again. And we're already getting that. There's no doubt about it. We're getting that now with the return to football. But I would love something more of enjoyment and expression. And to be honest, I feel like that full expression of football doesn't really happen until at least some of the people are back in the ground.
Yeah, definitely. It's hard to argue with you. No matter how hard they're trying to make it look like football, it's still not the same, especially not when you're attending the games, as you also shared with us, Sid. Sid Lowe, thank you so much for taking time out of your driving experience in the mountains north of Madrid. The connection worked fine, so everything's good.
I'm very pleased.
On behalf of everyone, thank you, and I also would like to give you a warning / promise you decide that we would very much like to call you up another time to get more of your brilliant insights on Madrid.
Yeah, that would be a pleasure.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Sid. Have an enjoyable game today and a good drive.
Thank you. Nice one. Take care. See you later.
Bye.
Bye-bye.